You are listening to the Dharma Ocean podcast. A distinctive feature of Vajrayana Buddhism is the view that emotions are intelligent expressions of energy. In this episode, Reggie says that when we relinquish our preconceptions, we glimpse how truly limitless our experience of life can be. This talk was given at the 2006 Advanced Meditating with the Body Retreat in Crestone, Colorado.
So this morning I'd like to talk to you about the view of emotions within the framework of the of Vajrayana Buddhism. And as always in working with you, I begin with the experience and the practice and the exploration, and then we and sharing, you know, what our insights and what we've been through, what we've seen and understood, and then later I'll present the theoretical framework. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a theoretical framework, and then we'll do some practice. So there are so many things about emotions that are that we need to explore. And, we worked a lot with anger yesterday and somewhat just got started. And, you know, we could easily, I was thinking, you can take each of the emotions. We could have spent a whole 2 or 3 days on paranoia, 2 or 3 days on grief, 2 or 3 days on fear, 2 or 3 days on pride. And that would really be worth doing. It would really be worth doing. Maybe, I don't know, I think I almost feel like next year at the intensive we should just go further, in terms of what we have done this year, because the emotions are so central. And there is a whole body of practice. We're going to do a little bit today and I'll show you some things, but there's a whole body of practice around the emotions that I think, this group is ready for, and we probably should begin, I should begin to unfold it. Where do the emotions fit in to the development of ego and to the spiritual path? And I'll just say a little bit. Once we clear away the debris of conceptual thinking, which we're beginning to do together in the body work, once we clear away the debris, and sometimes it's like in a pond with a lot of sort of debris on the surface, and you can clear a little bit away from the surface, and you can see down into the depth of the pond, and then the surface tension pulls the debris back over again, and we're kind of at that level in our work, but we do have a sense of the depth of the pond. Many of us do. We've had glimpses one way or the other. And those glimpses are actually very, very important because they show you that it's real. That there is a pond under the debris, and it does have a lot of depth to it, and it is something that calls us very much. So those glimpses are really an essential part of the path. We're working at that level, but actually also, as we've talked about through the body work, we're actually clearing debris and taking it out of the pond, of the surface of the pond. And as we do that through the body work, the debris itself becomes there's less because it spreads out again. And then we take more out, we see down, and then it spreads out again. And as we go through this process, the debris itself is becoming actually less. And at a certain point, we can start to see the gaps in the debris and as we go along. So it's an unfolding process. What we discover through that process is that our basic nature, when we're not tied up with our thinking process, is, in fact, empty space. And the glimpse of empty space is, at our level, is momentary. And what happens is that the minute there's a little opening in the framework of ego, we immediately shut back down again. And that's how we work. But the interesting process of shutting down, if we do a lot of meditation and we really observe how that shutting process shutting down process occurs, we find out actually that there are many levels actually in the shutting down process. Initially, there is that same gap that we experience when we clear the debris away for a moment through our practice. Actually, we begin to realize that that happens all the time in our lives, that there's a constant shift of mind all the time when there's a perception or someone says something or a thought arises or an emotion arises. There's a constant little opening through our whole life. This is what the word tantra means, continuity. And it's not the continuity of our ego, but the continuity of these momentary gaps into the basic nature of mind. That's the continuity, and it runs through our whole life. And you could say, well, it feels like ego is pretty continuous. But ego is actually not continuous. Ego is our constant covering over every time that gap opens up through some kind of experience that we have, any kind of experience or sudden shift of perception or mental events or whatever. Every time that little opening occurs, we shut back down. So actually the real continuity is the awakened state. And the ego is just this continual closing off of that possibility, and we actually have to work at it. You have to really work to have an ego. It's exhausting. That's why we sleep at night. Because all day long we've had to constantly cover over the awakened state every single moment of our lives in order to actually be me. Now you could say, well, if ego doesn't have any fundamental continuity, if it's just this repeated movement of, you know, covering over the vastness of our state of being, why are we the same person, seemingly, from moment to moment? Well, one thing is, we're not really the same person from moment to moment. And you can see that if you take a small child all the way to a person at the edge of death. Obviously, there's been a change throughout all of life, and it's not like there are one or two changes. Actually, every moment there's a change. And when you add those changes up, at the end of life, we have somebody who may be a very, very different person. I mean, yes, there will be some continuity, but there's really not much. There's not that much continuity. The main continuity is in the storyline that we have carried through our whole life and continue to refine. Our storyline, or in postmodern thought, they call it a narrative, our personal narrative, you know, the drama that we are constantly creating and recreating through our entire lifetime. Because we are constantly working on it, we have the impression that we're the same person. But what is the same thing is the process of recreating the drama. That's the thing that we come back to over and over and over. There's the appearance of continuity, but there is no continuity, not really. Well, then you could say, well, but there seems to be some continuity. You know, there's an incremental change. Every minute I'm not a totally different person. And that's because the way in which we cover over the awakened state or the basic nature, we have certain habitual ways we do that, which we've learned. It's learned behavior. We've learned certain habitual ways that reside in our body and mind. And every time we cover over the awakened state, we do it in that particular habitual way. And so, because we do it the same way, that gives us a defined personality. Now, this is a very interesting point, because when you meet people who are realized people, and my example is always going to be Chogyam Trungpa, because I was around him a lot, this is a person in whom there wasn't really very much evidence of any kind of continuity of personality. I mean, from a certain point of view, he had the same physical body and he had the same voice. He spoke English in a certain way. But fundamentally, being with him in situations, you did not have the feeling that the man was operating out of the same kind of set of habitual responses that most people operate out of. And each situation would be very impossible to predict or anticipate how he might respond. You actually couldn't do it. And of course you would try, because we do this with all people. You know, when we go out to tea with somebody, whether we know it or not, you know, a friend, there's an entire scenario that we're visualizing about that friend based on past memory. And while certain things may happen at that tea that may be surprises, nevertheless, the overall framework is probably not going to be challenged in most cases. But with Rinpoche, that was not possible. And he simply did not operate out of habitual responses. And, you know, in terms of my experience, the man did not have a personality. He didn't have one. It wasn't there. There was no personality. And something that I think I mentioned in 2005 to the 2005 group was that this very interesting point that one of his attendants told me that every time Rinpoche would go on a trip, he would come back, he'd be a completely different person. He was so open to his environment that he was able to receive from the people he met and the places he went and the things he went through himself, even if he just went away for a week. And he said that when Rinpoche came back, he had to actually get to know him all over again because he didn't know who he was. And Rinpoche would have different ways of doing things. With each person who was his attendant, there was a very specific way of doing things. For example, Rinpoche couldn't even take a shower because he was paralyzed on one side. So one of his attendants would actually have to go in the shower with him and hand Rinpoche the soap and then hand Rinpoche, you know, whatever he needed. And there was a very specific way of doing it, and they always did it the same way. But the strange thing was that with every different attendant, it was a completely different routine. You know, if there were five people, or let's say seven people, one per day during the week, who would help him take his shower, with each different person, it was a completely different routine. But with that person, it was always the same routine. In other words, the continuity was provided by the attendant, not by Rinpoche. And yet he understood the habitual pattern of the attendant, you know, that they had developed this habitual pattern together. And so he did it that way with that attendant. But with a different attendant, it was a completely different thing. Different soap, different order, different way to put the tooth on toothpaste on a toothbrush, you know, the whole routine. So this is all by way of saying that the whole notion of being me and maintaining continuity is not necessary. It's not a necessary thing, but it is something that we do. And the reason we do it is out of fear and anxiety. We do it because we have become habituated to having a relatively static sense, or let's say self-image of me. And again, that's something that, it's not something that's inherent in us. It's actually a set of habitual patterns that we're recreating literally every moment of experience. We recreate it. Every moment of experience destabilizes our self-image, or I wouldn't even say destabilizes, it actually destroys it. And you can see this all day long. If you walk around and you're going slow enough, and on retreat, you do have a chance to see this. This is why one reason retreat is such an eye-opening experience, because you see that you look out the window and you suddenly realize the moment that you look out the window and you see that blue sky, there actually is no one there in that instant. But then you come back and you have some thought about the blue sky, or even you recognize the blue sky as the blue sky. And then it happens again. You know, it happens again. You know, there's a chirp behind you, or a buzzing fly on the window behind you. And in that instant that you hear the buzzing fly, there's actually no one there. There's no me. There's just the buzzing fly. There is, in other words, sense perceptions are opening you to this basic vastness of our own state of being. And our awareness at that moment is truly limitless. But because we are so familiarized with the process of being me, we immediately shut that down. And we actually do it. It's not that it happens by itself. We actually are the ones that actually shut down that vastness and reconfirm my sense of me. And the thing is, when you hear the buzzing of a fly, the first moment that you hear it, you don't even know it's a fly, and you don't even know it's buzzing. it's the experience itself is that free of any kind of label or recognition of any sort whatsoever. And then you recognize buzzing, and then you recognize, oh, it's a fly, it's on the window. And we go through this process, and this is how we actually shut down. If your mind remains open, then there's just some kind of energy in the space, and there's no sense of recognition. This particular insight, you know, lest you think this is something written in some ancient book, this is one of the Mahamudra practices that I teach to my Vajrayana students, where you actually experientially unpack the presentation of sense experience. You actually look at sense experience and you rest deeper and deeper, and you see how sense experience actually arises, and that within sense experience actually there is no sense of any kind of recognition, labeling, or restriction. And restriction is what happens. The minute you think, oh, that's a fly, then the possibilities of the sense perceptions have been drastically reduced. Our basic state is this open, literally fathomless. You know, when we do the earth breathing, you know there's no bottom, don't you? I mean, there is no bottom. And that's what we call fathomless. In other words, there is actually no end to the vastness of the mind itself, to awareness. And, you know, truly the mind itself and reality are the same thing. Do you know that? I mean, has this become obvious, at least from my teaching, that when we talk about the mind, we're talking about awareness as the basic nature of mind. And the basic nature of awareness is coextensive with all of time and space. So the nature of our mind is the nature of reality itself. When we contact the mind itself, which we are beginning to do through the body work, the nature of that mind is reality. So in other words, you can't say there's the mind and reality. No. There's a teaching in the Dzogchen tradition, coming back to the source, you know, that we've been talking about. And this is called the child luminosity and the mother luminosity. The mother luminosity is all of time and space, which is without limit or boundary, and it's empty. But at the same time, there's a vivid sense of knowingness that pervades all of time and space. Thomas Merton wrote about this right before he died. In his Asian journals, he said he realized that the nature of all reality was Dharmakaya. He realized this. As a Christian contemplative man goes to Asia, he goes to the Buddha, reclining Buddha in Sri Lanka, and he realizes that the nature of all time and space is the Dharmakaya. What the Dharmakaya is our mind, our awareness. Or let's put it this way, our awareness actually is coextensive with all it is. So, you know, that is the mother luminosity, and it is the mother luminosity, it's not the father luminosity. I just want to point that out. And then the child luminosity is our experience of when we start to tap into the vastness in our own state of being. You know, the first line of the chant is, the body is the Buddha awareness all-pervading. You know, we begin to find that vastness in our state of being. Now, the thing is, we haven't actually realized it as all time and space. Of course not. I mean, that's something that is the fruition of the path. At the same time, the quality, when we do clear away the pond and we look into it, the quality is the same. And what happens through the path is we begin to not need to have any sense of restricted awareness at all. Even when we do the body work, there is a little bit of a sense that the body is the gate and the body is the reference point. You know, there is some sense of a container for this experience that we're exploring. But as we go further, we don't need the container so much. And at that point, the child luminosity is dissolving into the mother luminosity. And at death, the child dissolves definitively into the mother luminosity, and we are only the mother luminosity. We recognize ourselves as the source. Now, to talk in that way is, it's frightening for us, because what about me? I mean, I want to achieve enlightenment. I want to achieve realization. You know, I want to experience these things. And, I mean, who would want to dissolve into the source? Well, you know, the thing is, we do. And as I say often in this work, until we dissolve into the source, we will never, ever find fulfillment. Final fulfillment and the goal, actually, of our life in our deepest heart of hearts is, in fact, to realize that we are not and never have been anything other than the source. As I was saying yesterday in the Bodhisattva work, we are constantly giving away our illusions of ourself. I mean, that's really what the Bodhisattva path is from the viewpoint of the Bodhisattva. Of course, we're helping beings, we're extending, but the way we help them is we're constantly giving up the territory, my personal territory, which is made up of all the illusions I have about myself. And the more we give up and the more we let go, the more we realize actually that we are the source. There is actually no me. There's just the source operating in and through this human body. So if, you know, on the one hand, we're very frightened by the notion of dissolving into the mother luminosity and recognizing ourselves as nothing other than the mother luminosity, which is the source, which is all time and space. We're frightened by it, but at the same time, it's actually what we want. And the more sensitive we are, the more likely we are to follow the path and to be very clear that that's the only way we're ever going to find what we're searching for in life.
More of Reggie's teachings, find out about upcoming retreats, and to explore a variety of audio listening guides to assist you on your spiritual journey, please visit dharmaocean.org. Music is by Jeff Beal and Nawang Ketchog from the album Tibet, Cry of the Snow Lion.